Our last case this morning is 2022-155 Butler County Bar Association versus Dennis Charles Mahoney. Respondent?
May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
May it please Chief Justice O'Connor and the members of the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to also make some points or draw the court's attention to some points that we think merit your attention. First, Mr. Mahoney did not violate Rule 8.4C, which deals with fraud, misrepresentation, and the like. He didn't lie to anybody. He made a truthful statement about something that was going on, and it was true then, it's true now, and it's always going to be true. Further, I'll circle back to that in more detail. In the case of, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, MACECO, Mahoney County Bar Association versus MACECO, which was decided by this honorable court in February of this year, this court held that a violation of Rule 8.4C must be willful, and that means intentional and not simply a mistake. So even if we assume, for the sake of discussion, that Mr. Mahoney did state something that was improper, it was not willful. When Mr. Mahoney told the Chiropractic Wellness Center that there was not enough money to go around and pay everybody in this case, which unfortunately sometimes happens, that was a true statement. Because under Rule 1.2, Mr. Mahoney needs his client's authority to settle the case. He obtained that authority, and the client said, in effect, you can settle for X dollars, provided I net out Y dollars. Now, this was before he had had the conversation or the communication, I guess I should call it, it was by email, with the paralegal from Chiropractic Wellness Center. So Dennis crunched the numbers. He said, we can do this, and they did it. Unfortunately, in this case, we had a big Cairo bill, which was in the neighborhood of about $13,000, and we also had, and this was before Mr. Mahoney got involved in the case, a funding loan, and those get very expensive very quickly. And it's not a situation, as I'm sure all the members of the court are aware, where Mr. Mahoney fills out a withdrawal slip, goes to the insurance company and says, I want this much. These cases are vigorously contested, and that's fine. And this one was certainly going to be vigorously contested on the amount of the chiropractic bill. Further, when
so who was going to contest the chiropractor bill?
I'm sorry.
Who was going to contest the chiropractor's bill?
As to the amount?
The amount.
Well, the client had expressed some indication that she might, and some indication that she might not.
Okay, so he has a lump sum that is going to go to his client, right?
Yes, a net sum at the after other deductions have been made.
Okay. There were, his fee was one of the deductions?
There was an attorney fee, yes.
Okay, and then you said there was a loan to be repaid?
Yes, it was a settlement funding loan from a settlement funding company.
Okay.
And I'm sorry.
All right, what else?
Medicare.
Okay. So after that's done, there was enough money to pay the chiropractor, but she wasn't going to net what she wanted. Is that fair to say?
Right. That is very fair to say.
All right. So what the client here hoped to get, wanted to get, demanded to get out of the settlement really is irrelevant. The chiropractor's bill comes first. Is that not correct?
I would very respectfully disagree. The chiropractic bill does not come first because under the law of Ohio, which in this case is Rule 1.15, it doesn't come first. Rule 1.15 says the lawyer only protects interests in which he has actual knowledge, not subjective knowledge, but actual knowledge of a lawful claim. That's found in 1.15D, but it says this is for the rule, not just for this division, but for the entire rule. And Mr. Mahoney had no knowledge that he had no actual knowledge. He knew what people might claim or say or want. But he had no actual knowledge that the chiropractor bill was a valid claim. And even at the hearing, the chiropractor's office could not tell us what the amount of their bill was. So they're saying to Mr. Mahoney, pay our bill. What's the amount of your bill? We don't know. Puts him in an extremely impossible situation. Because, Your Honor, unless he has a clear legal right to take money from the client, if he takes that money, it's not going to be the Chiropractic Wellness Center filing the ethics grievance against him, as happened in this case. It's going to be the client.
Didn't he use the chiropractic bill to negotiate the settlement, that this was her medical expenses?
Well, he's, among other things, he sent it in. I always send them in, but I think they're more of a burden than they are a benefit. Coach Trussell, when he was a football coach at Ohio State, had a saying, nothing good happens after 10 p.m. So I want all my players home by 10 p.m. I had a saying, and I used to do hundreds and hundreds of these cases, nothing good happens when you have a chiropractic bill that's in excess of $45,000.
Well, isn't the practice to call the chiropractor and say, hey, I'm negotiating with the insurance company, or trying to get a settlement?
If there is such a practice.
And sometimes the chiropractor will say, we understand, and take something rather than risk going to trial and getting nothing.
Well, if there is such a practice, that's fine, but that's different from what the law says. The law says, under Rule 1.5, the lawyer must have actual knowledge of a lawful interest.
But didn't you say he knew that, he knew, he sent in these bills as support for his damages claim?
Okay.
Right? So he knew that there was a...
Well, he knew that chiropractor had provided, or said he had provided, some treatment, but whether you're going to collect that at a trial, as particularly a bill in this large amount, going back to the Coach Trussell Bill Mandrell, is highly, highly, highly problematic.
At that point, when he's trying to negotiate with the insurance company, he has a number from the chiropractor. Wasn't it around 13,000 some?
I believe you're correct. And at that time, yes, Your Honor, you're correct.
He had a number. This is what the chiropractor billed his client.
Yes. And the bill, I don't believe, reflected the fact that GEICO Insurance had paid $5,000 and some dollars toward that claim, and then stopped paying, claiming the chiropractor's treatment was excessive. I'm sorry, did I?
Okay, so I'm just, he had a number. He used that number with the insurance company in order to represent medical bills that his client incurred for the settlement.
He sent it in. I don't think he ever expected to recover much on the chiropractic bill in that amount, and I wouldn't expect to recover that.
Well, why would he give it to the insurance company that is going to, you know, issue the settlement?
Well, the reason I used to do it is because, and Dennis, Mr. Mahoney, I know is like this, he'll try cases, he'll file them and try them, and that used to be my philosophy. So what I always did, as soon as I could, pre-suit, is send them everything, because when I file suit, they're going to ask for all this stuff, and there it is, it's right there, and I didn't hide it from you. Further, if you're a skilled negotiator, sometimes a bad chiropractic bill, a problem bill, if you're a skilled negotiator and you have your share of the breaks, can actually help you, because you can say to the insurance adjuster who's on the other side, look, I understand what you're saying. This bill is excessive, and I'm not going to make a big deal about that beyond $4,000 to $5,000. So I'm going to give you that one. But if I'm going to give you that one, you know, we have to do this with some reciprocity. You know, I'm going to be reasonable with you.
Also, at the end of the day, when he received a settlement from the insurance company, did he think the chiropractic bill went away?
No.
He knew it was outstanding.
He knew there was a bill from the chiropractor.
It was outstanding, unpaid.
Well, some of it had been paid by GEICO.
He knew that there was a bill out there that was unpaid.
So
he knew the chiropractor was claiming that, but he didn't know if that's a lawful bill.
And so there's no obligation on his part to determine whether that was a legitimate bill?
Not according to Rule 1.15, which is the relevant law. 1.15D, and it says, this applies to the whole rule, not just to the division, the lawyer only pays the amount that he or she has actual knowledge is a valid, lawful claim. And he didn't have that knowledge, still don't have it. The chiropractor's office at the hearing, as recently as that, said, we don't know what he owes. That puts him in a tough situation with his client, who's going to file a legal ethics complaint, probably, or at least very plausibly, and plausibly a malpractice case, if he then takes money and gives it to somebody without having a clear legal right to do so. So he did the right thing here. And it's been this way since the rule was amended in approximately, I think it was 2009. And this is, I think, why you don't see many of these cases. I don't recall seeing any of these types of cases before this one.
So Mahoney, your client was the second attorney on the case.
Yes,
and,
Your Honor.
The two medical providers in question, Open MRI and CWC, were actually, their services were used before your client ever came on the case, correct?
They what before my?
They were, these services were used and done before your client came on the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct?
That's correct.
So, you know, I'm looking at the question of the release that she signed really had to do with her prior lawyer. And then when she decided to settle the case, she expressly said, I need to get this number, and that necessarily excluded MRI and CWC.
Well, eventually the MRI bill, which is sometimes referred to as pro-scan imaging, same thing as open MRI, was 40, the gentleman from MRI testified at the end of the day, their unpaid bill is $47 and change. Dennis got that bill paid after he got the case, and I believe after the case was settled. The chiropractic bill, we still don't know what they're actually claiming he owes. When I asked the gentleman from Open MRI, what does Dennis owe you? Does he owe you anything? I don't know. This is the answer. Did he ever try to trick you or deceive you or treat you in an unfair fashion? I don't know. They didn't file a grievance against Dennis. It was the chiropractor. And the chiropractor only did that after the chiropractor told Dennis, well, the chiropractor is paralegal, was trying to negotiate the bill by debating the law of Ohio. And Dennis said, I can't do that with you because you're not a lawyer, and I'm not allowed to assist you in the unauthorized practice of law in accordance with, for example, Rule 8.4A as an apple. So, excuse me. So what happened was, she then said, well, we're going to have our attorneys contact you. Okay, fair, very fair. And Dennis said, sent two emails, and they're both in the record, have your attorney contact me. He didn't just cut off discussion. He said, have your attorney contact me, because under, I think it's Rule 4.2, once the person says, we're hiring a lawyer, you really need to back off and not talk with them. And that's what he did, so he did it right. And it's a difficult situation, but it, for him, it's not an academic situation, it's real life, and he certainly doesn't want to not pay somebody if he can get them paid, but sometimes you can't do it, particularly when you have large chiropractic bills. There's other reasons in addition, but a chiropractic bill over $45,000 is almost always a headache or a very big headache because juries don't like them.
Let me go back to your argument about 1.15D. You say, well, reason you 1.15D says for purposes of this rule, the rule means that it applies to the rule, not just that subdivision. The third party's interest shall be one of which the lawyer has actual knowledge. And so he had actual knowledge of a chiropractor interest. One of which, and shall be limited to a statutory lien. That doesn't qualify. A final judgment, that doesn't qualify. But then it says, or a written agreement by the client or the lawyer on behalf of the client guaranteeing payment from the specific funds or property. She entered into an agreement guaranteeing that she would pay out of a settlement the chiropractic bills, right?
Not with the chiropractor.
Not with the chiropractor? Isn't that? She had no agreement with the chiropractor that she would?
This case has no letter of protection. There is a statutory lien involving Medicare. There's no judgment directing Mr. Mahoney to pay X amount to.
But didn't she sign an agreement with the, I'll go back to what the panel found, but didn't they find that she had an agreement with the chiropractor?
I've not seen it.
Well, wasn't her agreement with her insurance company, or maybe I'm looking at the settlement release.
She did have obligations with respect to her insurance company. It was a Florida, this was a Florida policy, and it was a personal injury protection policy, so it's not the typical.
Well, let me read to you what the panel said. It says, when she began treatment with Chiropractic Wellness Center, Moody signed documents labeled a confidential patient information sheet and an irrevocable power of attorney and a doctor's lien. Language on the CPI, that's the confidential patient information sheet, authorized direct payment of insurance benefits to Chiropractic Wellness Center, and the irrevocable HPOA likewise authorized Chiropractic Wellness Center to demand payment from from insurers directly, among other actions. The doctor's lien form included language to the effect of placing a lien on any settlement as a result of the accident giving rise to the treatment conferred on Moody.
The lien absolutely does no such thing. And if you look at the lien, which is pretty much some chicken scratches on a piece of paper, it just doesn't say that. And the lien, neither the lien does not name Dennis Mahoney, his law firm, any other lawyer, any other law firm. It doesn't.
But does it place, I mean, what the panel says, it places a lien on any settlement as a result of the accident. That's not true?
That is not true. It places, I don't see that. Now, if somebody shows that to me, obviously I'm a facts person, I would agree. But I believe the chiropractor even said, or their representatives, that that document isn't even relevant here. And the power of attorney, the so-called power of attorney, simply said, we, the chiropractor, can bill your insurance companies, not your lawyer, your insurance companies directly, get a check from your insurance company, cash your check, and deposit that check into our account. So those aren't any kind of letters of protection or anything of that nature. Further, Mr. Mahoney has not been charged with violating Rule 1.15D as in dog, which deals with letters of protection, statutory liens, judgments instructing him or any lawyer to pay certain amounts out of a settlement fund or money being held to certain parties. He wasn't charged that. Originally, he was told he would be charged with a violation of the American Bar Association rule, 1.15D. And we talked about that, and that was obviously not the law of Ohio. Then he was told he'd be charged with Ohio Rule 1.15D. And we explained, respectfully, he didn't violate that rule. Then it became a 1.15E as in Edward case. So we've had this kind of moving target, and it ended up in E as in Edward case. And the only time of which I am aware that you pay under E is if the lawyer has actual, not subjective, actual knowledge of a lawful interest. An example would be if a lawyer hires a jury consultant, and the jury consultant does $10,000 of work, hypothetically, and the lawyer has seen the work and knows that it's a valid bill from the jury consultant. If the client says don't pay that, under E as in Edward, because the lawyer in that case has actual knowledge of a valid interest, because he or she's been intimately involved with that along the way, then the lawyer can hold the money in trust while that dispute between, in that example, the jury consultant and the client is resolved. Your Honor, I believe my time has expired.
Yes.
So unless there are any other questions, I'll simply say thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, Mr. Mann, my name is Chris Pagan, I represent the Bar Association. My opponent began with the 8.4C violation, so I'll start there. Relator's Exhibit 5, our email correspondence between the respondent attorney and the chiropractic office, and in Relator's Exhibit 5, Mr. Mahoney said, there were insufficient funds to pay all of her outstanding bills. That was a false statement. Prior to that, Mr. Mahoney had evaded correspondence from the chiropractic agency after the case settled. We believe that is circumstantial evidence for an 8.4C violation because it shows concealment and intent. My opponent raised the Masco case.
Can I ask you before you go on, was there what obligated Mr. Mahoney to secrete or keep deposited a certain amount to be sure all his clients' bills were paid. What required him to do so?
That's not the 8-4, that's the 115. So we contend, the Bar Association contends, and I think the panel found, that 115E in this circumstance obligated him to hold the disputed funds because two or more persons claimed a reasonable interest in it because they provided medical services in the case that were uncompensated.
And you read the rule to say that that's required any time, you know, without any contractual obligation on the attorney to any third party. The attorney is required to, and I'm sorry to skip you forward in your argument, but that right. The attorney is required to, under that provision, to keep the funds secured until the dispute is resolved.
E triggers a holding duty. That's correct. And we contend that the elements of 115E were satisfied here to trigger that holding duty. Does that answer your question?
So in this case, some medical providers said right. We weren't fully paid. If the client said, I'm dealing with that and finding with my insurance company, that has nothing to do with my settlement.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
If these were people or entities that provided medical services to the client, and you're saying that 1.5 or 115E says, because those are legitimate or potentially legitimate claims having to do with this litigation.
Right.
The rules require me to keep those funds
in trust.
In trust until it gets resolved.
Until the dispute is resolved.
Regardless of if the client says, I'm dealing with that on my own, or I'm dealing with that with my insurance company.
Right. What the client did here was unlawful. I mean, you have an obligation to promote your client's interest, to do it zealously, all of that, but they have to be lawful interests.
And how does the attorney know that it's a lawful claim? Some of the bill was paid, some of it wasn't. The client's disputing some of it. There's evidence that the chiropractor is kind of unsure what the bill is anyways. Where does the attorney draw the line between the client's interests and this kind of a situation?
I think the point of the rule is that the attorney doesn't draw the line, that he or she holds the matter in trust until it can be negotiated or compromised, and at a last resort, you go to court and have the claims adjudicated.
But do you agree with Mr. Mann then that then instead of the chiropractor's office filing the disciplinary complaint, it would be the client?
What I understand your question to be is that the client then would file a grievance against his attorney or her attorney because she believed that the wishes were disregarded.
It's kind
about
of the
way.
Sword of Damocles, you know, either the chiropractor is going to file the disciplinary complaint or the client is.
Yeah, there's nothing unethical about holding money that's subject to a reasonable dispute in trust.
But in real life, you know, a client who's saying, I don't owe this money to the chiropractor, whether she's correct or not, and the attorney holds it, and the attorney's not even been a party to the agreement with the chiropractor, because this is the second attorney on the case, so we should find that he has violated the disciplinary code in this situation?
Yeah, by not holding. And you know, the interesting point about your question is, you know, you claim, or the what's inherent in your question is that there's some uncertainty about the bill. What wasn't, Mr. Mahoney just stopped communicating to the chiropractor. The chiropractic bill was covered by Florida PIP insurance.
Sure, but I think if we assume what Mr. Mann said is correct, should Mr. Mahoney have continued to communicate with a paralegal working in a chiropractor's office who said, you're going to be hearing from our attorney?
Maybe not, but that doesn't eliminate the duty under 115E to hold the money in trust when you're aware of a reasonable dispute in the funds that would harm third parties. So,
counsel, let me turn to paragraph 39 on aggravation. List four factors, one of which is dishonest motive. I'm sorry. But on paragraph 43, it says, while aggravating factors are present, many of those related to professional conduct rule 1.15E can be attributed to misunderstanding that rule, not selfishness. Which ones relate to misunderstanding versus selfishness?
I think that I'll try to answer it this way. I think Mr. Mahoney's conduct here was motivated to satisfy his client, to get a case settled without having to file suit, to get a maximum benefit for his client, shortchange the medical providers, and that's a selfish motive. Okay. At the same time, I think the panel has brought up the fact that there isn't clear guidance from this court that demarcates a 115E and a 115D violation, and to the extent that that legal argument was brought to the panel, that they understand and see that as a good faith argument.
One of the comments for 1.15 talks in effect about an interpleader action of some type.
Right.
Could that have been done here?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and as Justice Donnelly points out, I mean, in the standard course of practice, these things, you get a settlement, you negotiate with the providers, and you compromise, and things work out. And it's a very rare case where it's going to go to litigation. But it can, and that is a remedy available to the attorney here when he's holding the money and the case can't resolve.
You're in the middle of the case, you're trying to resolve it.
Right.
Come up with this dispute with the client. If you file an interpleader, aren't you adverse to your client then?
Well, then maybe you have to withdraw and allow somebody else to take it on, and that's just the way that you have to ethically navigate through that. So.
The rules provide that the willful breach shall be punished by reprimand, suspension, disbarment, or probation, right? And then we have the panel saying no applicable case law would be located wherein a foot fault occurred in deciphering the difficult obligations imposed by first or conduct rule 1.15 D and E. I mean, can we say that a foot fault is a willful breach of the rules?
Can you say that a foot fault is a breach of the rules?
No, a willful breach of the rules.
Again, I think going back to what I addressed with Justice Fisher, I think the panel is saying that that this court needs to issue an opinion, a clear opinion, that demarcates between 115D and 115E.
If the rules aren't clear, that would seem a very good argument not to issue a public reprimand.
Well, we have two violations here. One is the lie, and then one is the failure to hold funds and prejudice the medical providers that provided uncompensated services to the client. So the foot fault would address 115. It doesn't address 8.4. It doesn't excuse lying to a third party.
Was it really a lie, or essentially, and I agree it wasn't very well worded, but essentially it was saying there wasn't enough money to do everything. I mean, I don't think, I mean, it would seem if you're a medical provider listening to that statement, you'd have to be pretty skeptical that there is really no funds left after all the medical bills covered everything, since you'd actually had some idea what the damages were and the settlement was, right? So
I think what you just did was insert words that aren't present in the email, and you have to change the facts in order to.
But there's some context, right? I mean, the providers knew what the bills were. They communicated with the insurance company, so they knew what the settlement was. So it's hard to.
Knew there was a settlement, didn't know what the settlement was. So that, and that's an important fact, because there was no demarcation or a listing of actually what the bills were, what the settlement was, who got paid what in the communications to the chiropractor. There was just a statement that said, a false statement, that there were insufficient funds to pay all of our outstanding bills. That's just false. It's flatly false. And we have to reconstrue that email to make it true.
So, counsel, the board awarded $1,329 to the chiropractic.
Right.
Okay. Based on what we heard from the respondent's attorney, there were thousands of dollars in dispute.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't comport with less than $1,500 and saying that there's not enough money to pay these people.
Right. And an important point to that is that Mr. Mahoney, because I contend he never knew this, never understood that there was a 20% coinsurance obligation on his client. So GEICO paid the chiropractor 80% of what it deemed was reasonable and required the client to pay the 20% co-insurance. But that was never communicated to the chiropractor for that agency to know that they could look to the client, Ms. Moody, for that 20%.
Well, why would and that it, need to be communicated?
I'm sorry.
Why would that need to be communicated to the client? I mean, don't we all know when we go to providers, or aren't we all required to know how much we have to cover?
She should have known, right, and she didn't, and it wasn't communicated to the chiropractor at any time until in the middle of this litigation. I didn't learn about the 20% coinsurance obligation until I subpoenaed GEICO after we brought this case. My opponent didn't know. Mr. Mahoney testified at a pre-suit deposition in this case, never brought up the coinsurance, again, because he didn't know. And when the chiropractor at the hearing was presented with the information about the 20% coinsurance obligation, she said, we'll take that. That's fair. That's reasonable. Nobody told me that. That's why you hold monies in trust, so that those things can be washed out and legal responsibilities can be established and conformed to. And
but it doesn't a chiropractor is considered a medical provider, and
yes.
So it's normal for a patient to go in and submit their insurance card, and they have people on staff at medical offices who deal with the insurance companies. How would the chiropractor not know that just from the relationship with the client and her insurance?
Well, in evidence here, we have the sheet that was filled out by Ms. Moody, the client, and she didn't list GEICO for the chiropractor to know. And I think she listed Medicaid, but Medicaid either doesn't provide or cover chiropractic services, or this chiropractic office wasn't in the Medicaid group to get coverage. So that's why they relied on what Ms. Moody told them, and they didn't get full information either from the client or from Mr. Mahoney when they were trying to work it out. And I don't think Mr. Mahoney knew about the coinsurance under the PIP coverage until after this case resolved. Or was filed, not resolved, if that makes sense.
But Ms. Moody was done treating with this chiropractor by the time Mr. Mahoney took the case. Is that correct?
I have the fee agreement. I don't know the answer to that question, but I don't know why it's important. Because I just don't know why it's important. He collected their bills. He collected their records. He submitted it to the insurance company in the demand. He was aware of what the bill was and was on notice that it was disputed at the time when he settled the case and his client instructed him not to pay so she could get more money. I mean, that's the ethical rub here.
What kind of experience in personal injury law did he have before this?
Lots. Okay. Lots.
So when he says that part of the settlement was leaving out these two medical providers,
right.
Otherwise she wouldn't have settled for the amount that she did, what is your response to that?
That's not a fair thing to do. I mean, you can't shortchange uncompensated medical providers because your client makes an unreasonable, unlawful demand. In her release, and I think that you were kind of fumbling with this earlier in the case.
Thank you for calling it fumbling.
Well, I think you didn't know that it was released. You know what I mean? That's.
I said, I think it's the settlement statement and
right.
Accompanying documentation.
But the panel relied on the release, and in the release, she covenanted or obligated herself to as a condition of the settlement to pay back all uncompensated medical providers. And that's what she failed to do. She failed to follow her own word, and Mr. Mahoney facilitated her breaking that provision in the release for her own benefit, to the detriment of the medical providers. And I apologize for using the word fumbled. I was just trying to address a point that I thought.
Well, I probably was.
Okay. All right.
Counsel, your time's up.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, your time's up. You may take a minute.
I'm sorry, may I have a minute?
You may have a minute.
Yes, thank you. There's a lot of things I could say. The court's busy. I'll try to be brief. I believe our distinguished colleague from the Bar Association has admitted in front of the justices of this court that the law that's involved here is ambiguous. And I believe, as was stated,
well, okay, but he says, okay, even if you throw this out, though, he lied.
I'm sorry, if you throw out the...
Even if you throw out the violation about 1.15, there's still a violation because he lied when he said there wasn't enough money to cover all the medical bills.
There wasn't. I mean, if the client...
There was enough money to cover all the medical bills. There wasn't enough money to cover all the medical bills to pay, and also pay his bills and pay her what she wanted.
The client would not sign the release and the settlement draft or check.
Well, then you don't settle. Then you don't settle. The client has some legal obligations that your client knew about, okay? She says, I'll settle as long as you put this amount of money into my pocket.
Right.
That's what's controlling him.
Right.
Well, what he should have done is got on the phone with the chiropractor and negotiated a resolution with the outstanding and then settled in order to try to put that money into her pocket.
Your Honor, he certainly should have done that if that was the law, and it's not.
Well, that's the standard practice, and that's why I asked about his experience. This is done every single day by plaintiff's counsel.
Well, standard practice and the law of Ohio are not the same things. But if standard practice is going to be now the benchmark, I think this court should make that clear so that in cases such as this in the future, I could bring in 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 expert witnesses to state what the standard practice is.
Counsel, I'm confused. You, when we had our conversation about how much money was owed to this chiropractor, and I said $13,000 was an amount of money that your client, that's what I, you know, read in the record here. It's $1,300.
No, Your Honor. It was, if you add up the whole chiropractor's bill, it comes to $13,000 and
right,
some.
Which was paid by the insurance company, and 20% she has to pay, which is $1,329.
No, Your Honor. Approximately $5,000 plus was paid by GEICO. And the rest of what Your Honor said is correct.
That she owes $1,300. I don't care who paid it, whether it was GEICO, whether it was Medicaid, whether it was, you know, another insurance company. All she owed was $1,329.
Not according to the chiropractor. And this question was asked and re-asked.
How did the panel arrive at that amount?
That's an excellent question to which I don't have the answer.
Was there evidence presented at the hearing?
As to that number?
Yes.
I don't believe so, but...
So you're saying that the panel just pulled out the number of $1,329 for Chiropractic Wellness Center and $48.15 to open MRI, and that's just...
Well, the open MRI, I would not say that. The gentleman from open MRI testified they wrote $47 and change. So that's, in effect, 48-something. As the other number, I certainly don't want to be
critical. Just to clear this up, it's right in the opinion, $1,329 is what the woman from the chiropractor testified they would have accepted as full payment for the larger bill.
Okay. At the trial, when we asked how much does this gentleman owe you, Mr. Mahoney, according to you, the answer was repeatedly, we don't know. And that makes it very difficult for a lawyer in real life with a real life client to pay an appropriate amount when the person making the claim against you will not state what that amount is. And I don't think there's any dispute in the record that that's how the young woman from the Chiropractic Wellness Center testified. I don't know what he owes us. Unless there are any other questions, I'll simply say thank you very much.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.